Normally is the mostly Scott session. So we'll begin with an hour-long talk by Scott Aronson from MIT.
Okay, thanks a lot. It's great to be back in Waterloo. So what I want to talk about today is kind of I'd like to survey a new approach to quantum state estimation, which is able to get pretty dramatic improvements in terms of the number of measurements required over what people thought was possible. And it does so using one of my favorite techniques, which is redefining the goal. Okay. So I'm first going to talk about some theoretical results that I proved already a few years ago now, which kind of suggested that this sort of thing was possible. And then I'll talk about an actual numerical implementation of this technique by myself and my student, A.L. Dechter. And that's just from this past year. Okay, so there's a problem, which you'd expect, otherwise there wouldn't be a talk. So what's the problem? Well, the fundamental problem is that if you want to do quantum state tomography, say, on a general quantum state of n entangled qubits, then in general, you are going to need a number of measurements that increases exponentially with n. And usually when I give a talk about these sort of things, I have some slides about what is tomography and why do people want to do it, and so I assume that's not necessary here. So we would like to do tomography. We would like to sort of know what quantum states we're dealing with, and we would like to do that ideally, not just for small quantum states, of one or two particles, but eventually for large things that arise in condensed matter or maybe in quantum information. And the problem is that quantum states are these exponential objects, right? Even to just write down a description of them, it's going to take exponential time. So then the question that I ask is, okay, does this mean that sort of if we have a generic state of, let's say, 10,000 entangled particles, and suppose we just ignore where it came from, so we ignore sort of what circuit was used to produce it, or we ignore any symmetries it might have, we just think of it as a generic state, does it mean that sort of that such a thing can sort of never be learned within the lifetime of the universe? And if so, does it even mean that much to talk about sort of a general quantum state of 10,000 entangled particles, right? So this is certainly a practical problem. To me, it's sort of a conceptual problem about quantum mechanics as well. I guess the question, which Robin likes a lot is what is a quantum state? Right, people like to argue, is it a state of the world? Is it a state of knowledge? I sit out on that one. But I think that whatever else we want to say that a quantum state is, at the least it should be sort of a useful hypothesis that encapsulates previous observations and lets us predict future ones. Right, so I think we may not be able to say what a quantum state is, but at least we can answer the easier question of what does it do, or what does it have to be able to do, right? I think that's kind of a useful perspective, because then we can ask, okay, so how useful is a hypothesis that's going to take like 10^5000 bits even to write down, right? So if this is what a quantum state is, then some people would say that would maybe bolster the arguments of the quantum computing skeptics who think that it's such a theory that requires these sort of exponentially large descriptions of physical objects is just sort of inherently implausible, just like sort of all sorts of other theories that people have seen in computer science, involving real numbers represented to unlimited precision or something like that, and that, obviously it's going to have to break down in the sort of the large n limit. Sometimes when I talk to physicists, I have difficulty sort of explaining even what this point of view is, right? And then I go talk to the computer scientists, And they say to me, you know, like, why would you even imagine that quantum mechanics is true, right? And I, like, why would you even, right? And I try to, you know, say that maybe the past 100 years of experimental evidence is somewhat relevant, right? But, you know, to them, what's far more pertinent is that, you know, no theory with exponentially many bits is, can be correct, right? And okay, so I think really what we're talking about here is the David Hume's old, problem of induction, right? That we're talking about sort of this, we can step back from quantum mechanics and we can just think of the general problem of, what does it mean to sort of come up with a hypothesis that explains past data, lets you predict future data. So then the problem, Hume noticed is, you see 500 ravens, they're all black, right? Obviously, everyone would agree you can't conclude with certainty that the next raven you see is also going to be black. But the question Hume asks is, why does it give you any reason whatsoever to even, to even guess that the next raven is going to be black, right? What's the logical connection at all between one raven and another one? And so, you can give a Bayesian answer to that question, if you're willing to assume some prior, over the space of possible ravens and so on. But I think ultimately, whatever approach you take, the answer, at some level is going to boil down to see something about the simplicity of the universe. Okay, something about, the idea that a universe, where if the sun is risen every day, then it's going to rise again tomorrow, and if all the ravens are, you've seen are black, then the next one's probably also black. This is somehow simpler, more parsimonious than a universe in which, those things don't happen. And so, so there's this area called computational learning theory that tries to formalize this idea of simple hypotheses. And well, if you haven't seen it, it's actually I think it's very nice as sort of a Bayesian alternative, right? If like when people say, well, Bayesianism is the only way to reason about anything, and there are theorems that prove it, right? And and you can't even imagine what a different way of, rigorous way of reasoning would look like. I think this is a reasonable example of sort of a different, a theory of knowledge which sort of starts out with very different principles than Bayesian ones, and it's actually reasonable, right? So, there's trade-offs between the two, but so I wanted to tell you a little bit about, what is this approach that one takes in computer science, to problems of learning and prediction, in this area of computational learning theory. Okay. Well, as I said, the key idea is going to involve restricting attention to some sort of small class of hypotheses. And so to formalize that, Leslie Valiant in the 80s introduced a notion which is called probably approximately correct, or PAC learning. Okay. And so let me try to explain what this framework is. So basically, you have some set S, which is called your sample space. So for example, if you're an infant, who's trying to learn a language, then S, could be the space of sort of all possible sentences that could be spoken. Okay, and then you've got some probability distribution over the sample space. Okay, so whenever an adult opens his or her mouth, a sentence is drawn from some probability distribution. Okay, you don't have to know what the distribution is, but there's some distribution, and the idea that sort of you get a bunch of samples that are all drawn from the same distribution, that's sort of what in computational learning theory sort of codifies this assumption that the future is going to resemble the past, right? Or, as I like to put it, that sort of, nothing should be on the test that wasn't covered in class, right? That, you've got to have, you can't expect a baby to sort of know, about a language that it's never heard spoken before, right? So you need some such assumption. Okay. So, and then, You also, but then, you know, even given that, yeah, it's still, you know, as Hume pointed out, right, it's still given any finite amount of data, right, there's still sort of infinitely many curves that you can fit through it, right, that's still compatible with sort of any possibility whatsoever for any future data that you might see. And so you need to make some assumption about the sort of set of possible hypotheses. And so what you do is you say you've got some class C of hypotheses that are limited in some way. Usually you put some bound on the complexity of your hypotheses. Okay? You say that sort of every hypothesis, you know, has to be represented by a circuit with at most this number of gates. Okay? Or if you want something simpler, you know, every hypothesis has to be a low degree polynomial, or you know, or it has to be a hyperplane, or you know, or just something of some simple form. Okay? And now, you know, there's some unknown function, you know, in your hypothesis class, which is the truth, right? Which is the thing that's really governing your data, and that's what you would like to learn. Okay? And of course, you know, even after we've made all these assumptions, you still can't hope to learn it exactly. Okay? And you can only sort of ever hope to sort of get the truth approximately right. Right? You know, even the smartest baby in the world is going to make some grammatical errors, right? And then, you know, and even then, you can't hope that you're certainly going to get, you know, the truth approximately right. Right? After all, maybe you're really unlucky, right? If you're a baby and like the only sentence your parents ever say is like, you know, goo goo gaga, right? And then, you're just not going to have the data to you know, that's not even a sentence, but okay, so you know, so you're going to need, you know, some sort of, you know, at least a little bit of luck, right? You know, and so we've got sort of two fudge factors, and so we say what we want is that sort of given, you know, a bunch of data points drawn independently from your distribution, sort of together with the classifications of those data points. So like, you know, each one you could be told, is this a grammatical sentence or is it not a grammatical sentence, right? And then given that, you want to output some hypothesis from your class which predicts most of the future data drawn from that same distribution D, okay? Well, 1 minus epsilon fraction of them, and does it with high probability, you know, probability at least 1 minus delta over the choice of sample data. Okay? So that's probably approximately correct learning. So now the key theorem, you know, and there's the versions of this sometimes go by the name of the Occam's razor theorem. That's William of Occam, Gillette. So you know, so the key theorem is that if the you know, at least if you assume that the class of hypotheses is finite, then this kind of learning is at least sort of information theoretically possible after having seen only a very reasonable amount of sample data. In particular, after, you know, you've seen sort of this number of sample points. So it's saying, let's say you want to predict a 1 minus epsilon fraction of the future data, and you'd like to do that with probability at least 1 minus delta. Then in order to do that, you should have seen a number of samples which scales like 1 over epsilon times the log of the number of hypotheses divided by delta. Okay? So the key thing notice about this is that even if there are exponentially many hypotheses, you know, even if each hypothesis takes n bits to write down, right, then the number of samples that you need is not exponential because, you know, you're taking a log. Okay? So the number of hypotheses will, sorry, the number of the amount of sample data you'll need will only scale linearly with the number of bits needed to even write down the hypothesis. Okay, so you know, and it also scales reasonably with the error that you want to achieve. Okay, and you know, it's not quite obvious from looking at this, but sort of a version of this theorem is, you can interpret as saying that sort of compression implies prediction. Or in other words, sort of if you can come up with some description of the past data that you've seen, which takes fewer bits to write down than the data itself, right, then sort of that's the case in which you're justified in believing that your hypothesis is going to, you know, do a better than chance at predicting the future data. Okay. So, and in fact, you can even prove sort of in both directions that if you're predicting, then you must have had some sort of compressed representation of the past data, right? Which is kind of a very nice connection, I think. But okay, but now, you might wonder, what does any of this have to do with quantum states? Because, well, first of all, the number of quantum states is not finite. It's 2 to the L of 0, right? So, this theorem certainly doesn't directly apply. Now, of course, we can deal with that by we can just discretize quantum states, right? We can say, obviously, we only ever want to learn a quantum state up to some finite precision, right? But even if we discretize, if you think of how many different quantum states there are of n qubits, it's actually, we'll say every pair of which has a have large inner products. There are doubly exponentially many such states. Okay, and so you take the log of that, and you've got an exponential. Okay, or all I'm saying is a quantum state is just this thing that takes exponentially many bits to write down. Okay, so then the question, arises of how are we going to learn these things? Okay, we're just back to this problem of the sort of intractability of tomography talking about before. But I want to sort of try to give you a hint of what's possible. And the key idea is that quantum states are actually not these sort of generic exponentially long vectors, sort of these generic strings of exponentially many bits, sort of all of which you have to learn, right? Quantum states they live in Hilbert space, right? And Hilbert space has this very nice linear structure, and that's something that you can actually take advantage of. You don't have to ignore that. So I guess 4 years ago, sort of motivated by sort of questions in quantum computing or quantum complexity theory, I sort of proved a theorem which I'll state in the following way. It says if you've got sort of any sort of quantum state of n qubits, right? And let's say that okay, so obviously if you wanted to sort of write down that state, write down a classical description of that state. And so, it's in such a way that you could then sort of predict what's going to be the outcome of any measurement on that state. Well, that's just the same as writing down the state itself, right? And if there are n qubits, then that's going to take you exponentially many classical bits to write down that state, right? But let's say that there's only some subset of measurements that you actually care about, okay? So they're like for example, let's say you only care about measurements, that could be performed within the lifetime of the universe for some reason. Okay. Or, you only care about measurements, that could be applied using using n squared or fewer quantum gates where n is the number of qubits. Okay, something like that. Or maybe you only care about Pauli measurements, you only care about this or that. In any case, if there are only m measurements that you care about, and assuming each one of those is, let's say, a two outcome measurement, then I can write down for you, sort of given the state, given a description of the state and given descriptions of those measurements, I could write down for you a classical string of only sort of n times log m classical bits, such that then given that string, you could sort of approximately sort of predict the outcome of any measurement, in that set, any one of those m measurements applied to that state. Okay, so in particular, m could be exponential, and yet this is still a polynomial number of bits. Okay, polynomial number of bits can suffice to let you predict the outcomes of exponentially many different measurements. Okay, so this is sort of the compression theorem that I proved, and there's a more formal statement here, which is actually it's not the way I stated it in the paper, but maybe is more useful for tomographers. So we can just consider m two outcome POVMs on an n qubit mixed state, and then sort of given classical descriptions, the measurements in the state, we can produce a classical string, basically this number of bits. From which trace, e sub I rho can be estimated to within an additive error of epsilon, sort of given any e sub I. Okay. Yeah.
So
Yeah. Any assumption about whether N or M is larger? I mean, I assume both are larger.
Oh, no, they're, so.
I'll tell you
no,
why I asked.
Yeah, okay.
It doesn't seem surprising to me that if you have a small number of qubits and you do more and more measurements, not that much more information is really.
Right, well, that's basically what it's saying.
But if you have a large number of qubits and you're doing a small number of measurements, essentially each measurement could just be on a different qubit.
Yeah,
so I would expect a worse scaling with M.
Ah, but you do have an N there to help you, right? And okay, so I said like O tilde, so there could be like a log M, you know, plus one or something like that, right? You've got this N here, right, which is.
But if N is 1,000 times larger than M.
Yeah.
Then I would have expected this to scale linearly with the number of measurements you do, since they could be just be completely independent measurements.
Right. Well, first of all, this is an upper bound. Right, there's an upper bound. So you know, as long as sort of N is going to be larger, right, than the number of measurements that you're doing, right, then this bound still covers it.
So I just want to make sure that is the M number of measurements is what you mean binary measurement? It's kind of single qubit measurements?
No, that does not have to be single qubit. There's any measurement that has two that yields two possible outcomes, any two outcome measurement.
Oh, it could be correlated.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. It can be arbitrary. Arbitrary POVNs that have two outcomes. So, okay. So just to, you know, I'm not going to prove it here, you know, in this talk, but just to give you an idea of how you do prove it. You use an idea which has sort of occurred before in sort of classical computational learning theory, and it's sort of this idea of adaptive learning, or you know, you could call it sort of Darwinian training, right? So what you do is you sort of say, all right, you know, initially sort of not knowing what some quantum state is, you'll just make a guess as to what it is, and the guess will be, well, what else should it be? The maximally mixed state. Okay, and of course the maximally mixed state probably isn't that great of a guess. Okay, but then, you know, but this is okay because you can just keep correcting yourself. Okay, so what you can do is say, all right, so you say that the maximally mixed state is not a good a hypothesis. Well, then we've got these m different measurements that we care about. Then, all right, then find me a measurement where it gives the wrong answer. And then just tell me what the answer is for that measurement, you know, and then I'll take that into account. Okay, so in other words, then my hypothesis will be the state you would get by starting with the maximally mixed state and then post-selecting on that measurement, yielding that outcome that you said it should yield, right, and then just taking the resulting state. Okay, and of course, that still might not be a very good hypothesis. Okay, but in that case, just find me another one of these measurements where that state doesn't do well, and then I'll post-select on succeeding on that measurement also. Okay, and I'll just keep doing this, yeah.
Well, you're talking about post-selection.
Yeah.
So, a simple question. You say you can write down a classical description.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, can I generate this classical description in a polynomial number of polynomial time?
No. You can do it in time polynomial in the Hilbert space dimension.
Okay.
You can. In other words, an exponential time. So yeah, and that's really kind of the best that you could hope for, you know, unfortunately. And so actually, you know, the thing I'm going to show you next is actually, you know, a way to try to get around that you know, constraint of, you know, at least sort of the difficulty of generating this information. So yes, to generate this string sort of is going to, you know, require a lot of computational power, but you know, and then even to interpret what the string is telling you will also require a lot of computational power. But you know, you do what you can. Yeah.
So I'd like a little bit more detail on what post-selecting on their outcomes means.
So
suppose I have a POVM, my E1.
Mm-hmm.
It's got an outcome, the one that happens when I measure it, has a projector that's, you know, a bunch of ones and a bunch of zeros.
Yep.
So does that mean that when I observe that outcome, I set to zero all the probabilities in my state, I'm updating my state?
So what you do, let's say you have some quantum circuit that implements the measurement. Okay. So you sort of run that quantum circuit, make the measurement, you know, at the end of like some qubit, right, that, you know, that'll give you either a zero or a one. let's say the outcome is supposed to be one. Okay, so in that, at that point, you post select on it being one. And you know, you just throw away the branch of the wave function where it's zero. Okay, and then you uncompute your circuit. Okay, so you get rid of any garbage. So you just run your circuit backwards, you uncompute, and then you just take, you know, whatever state is sort of left over in that register where row was.
So, okay, so in other words, yeah. Really what I'm doing is I'm sort of collapsing the wave function. I'm looking at the post measurements.
Yeah, yes.
Okay, so in that case, how do I deal with the following situation? Mm-hmm. Trivial case, mm-hmm. my first measurement is sigma z on a single qubit, mm-hmm. up. Mm-hmm. So that collapses me to the up state. Mm-hmm. And the second measurement is also sigma z, and I mm-hmm. get down. Mm-hmm. Does my head explode at that point?
So I should say I'm skipping over a little bit here. And the thing you have to do sort of as a prerequisite is you need to amplify your state, which means that instead of dealing with the original state, you'll deal with sort of the tensor product of k copies of the state for some reasonable k.
Oh.
And then the measurement, so sorry, I skipped over that, but the measurement that you'll be dealing with will be actually a measurement where you would apply the original measurement to each one of those k copies and then take the majority of the outcomes. Okay. And this sort of pushes down your probability of error so that it's small enough that you can then repeat this process for a whole bunch of measurements within the set, and sort of each time you do it, if you started out with the correct hypothesis state, then your state would not be damaged that much by each time you do it. That's basically the idea. Anyway, you know, if you're interested in, you know, details how I prove it, you know, it's, I can point you to the paper, So you know, this, you know, at least gave a hint of what's possible. Although, as someone pointed out, you know, there is this sort of, you know, there's quite a computational difficulty to actually applying this theorem, right? It's a you know, an information theoretic result. Okay, so can we, you know, get rid of this idea that, you know, we need to invest all this enormous computational power to even sort of produce our classical sort of description of a quantum state? Okay, so a couple years ago, I generalized that other result to what I'll call the quantum Occam's razor theorem. Okay, and this is a theorem about hack learning of quantum states. Okay. And so again, you know, I stated the theorem, you know, in a not quite the way I did in my paper, but in a way that'll hopefully be more helpful for cryptographers. So let's say you've got some n qubit state row, right? And now, you know, you've got some probability distribution d, again, you know, over two outcome measurements. Okay, you don't have to know what d is, just you know, believe it exists. Okay, and now, you know, suppose that we've drawn sort of m measurements, e1 up to em, some various two outcome povns, sort of independently from this distribution D, okay? And, you know, imagine that we've applied all of them. Imagine we've applied each one to different copies of our, you know, of our state row, right? And for each one, we got some outcome, B sub I, right? Which would be either a zero or a one, okay? And so now, you know, let's say we find a hypothesis state that tries to fit our data as well as possible. And there are different ways that we could do that, but, you know, one particularly nice thing we could do is just try to find a least squares fit. Okay, just find a state sigma, which, you know, subject to being a valid density matrix, minimizes this sum of squares. Okay, yeah.
Isn't sigma an n qubit state also? Doesn't that make it monstrous?
It is monstrous, yeah, unfortunately.
So even with least squares, it's half a lifetime.
Well, okay, you can. You know, so we could at least hope that you know, there's, first of all, you know, there's some regime for which you know, I mean, the doing the actual measurements is sort of more expensive than the computation, right? So that you know, so that there's some regime where you know, at least, you know, you win, you can represent you know, at 2^15 by 2^15 matrix in MATLAB, right? Maybe, you know, you don't want to do that many experiments, right? So, you know, so what I was going to talk about later is, you know, there is sort of a great sort of, you know, I think fairly, you know, wide open research area, which is to sort of find special cases of this learning problem where the computation can be done you know, in an amount of time, which is polynomial on the number of qubits, rather than just polynomial on the Hilbert space dimension, right? So that's a great, you know, problem. I have some thoughts about that. But for now, yeah, let's say that, you know, the number of qubits is small enough that you can represent in your classical computer a 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix. Yeah. So, okay, so in that case, you know, you can hope to sort of find this thing sigma, and actually I'll talk later about just, you know, how in practice, you know, are you actually going to do that? There's actually a sort of a nice sort of custom algorithm for doing this, but find a sigma that sort of minimizes that sum of squares. So then what the theorem says, the content of the theorem is that if you find this state, you know, by whatever means, that sort of that does a good job, you know, that minimizes the sum of the squares, the differences for the measurements that you've seen, then that state, that hypothesis state, will probably predict, you know, the outcomes of most further measurements which are drawn from the same distribution too.
Okay.
So, you know, probability over measurements drawn from D, that trace of E rho is close to trace of E sigma, you know, will be large, and this will be true with high probability over the choice of sample measurements.
Okay.
So again, you know, we've relaxed the goal of quantum state tomography. Okay, where you know, the way Umesh Fazirani, you know, likes to put it is we're not trying to, you know, be able to identify for any object in the universe whether it's a chair or whether it's not a chair, right? We might be in a modern art museum and there are, you know, all sorts of border cases we're not trying to handle, okay? We're just trying to identify, you know, for most of the objects we're going to come across whether they're a chair or not, okay? And likewise, you know, our notion of quantum state estimation here is that for most measurements that might, you know, that we might want to apply in the future, we would like to know, you know, we'd like to be able to predict what is the probability of a yes outcome for that measurement.
Okay.
That's the notion. Okay, so what the theorem is saying is that we can do that, and that works, just provided we have a large enough number of sample measurements. And then how many sample measurements do we need? Well, that's really the key issue. And what this is saying is that the number of sample measurements only has to be linear in the number of qubits.
Okay.
It's not just, you know, not exponential, it's actually linear, the number of qubits. Okay, and then it's also polynomial in the inverses of all the error parameters. And that dependence on gamma and epsilon, actually, you know, it looks really bad, you know, and it is. But first of all, I believe that can be improved a great deal. You know, if you're willing to trade for sort of a, you know, like an n log squared n or something, I can already improve those things. And I'll show you later sort of data that seems to indicate that the actual dependence on gamma and epsilon is much, much better in practice than it is in this worst case bound. Yeah.
So there's something I don't understand. Because your POVM requires, in general, correlated measurements.
Yes.
So, I mean, in principle, we know that you can do a state tomography with a single, you know, measurement if you have a general POVM. So, I mean, in general, yeah, you can.
Well, what do you mean? I mean,
I'm
talking about a measurement on a single copy of the state here, right? Each of these measurements is applied to the.
But you have
copy.
K copies as well.
Yeah, but each measurement gets applied to sort of as just one copy of the state.
Right.
But you are doing the same measurement on n k.
No. Each time you draw some measurement, you know, E sub I, you know, you draw some measurement, E sub I from this distribution D, right? And then you apply that to a fresh copy of the state. Okay, and you look at the outcome, and that's your training data. Okay, so, you know, so again, I'm not going to go through the proof of this theorem. You know, fortunately for me, you know, I found that most of the work, you know, needed to prove it, it actually had been kindly done for me people, and I just sort of had to put it together. So there are results due to Bainas, Nayak, Tashma, and Bazarani, and then the Asher Nayak, that sort of give limitations on what are called quantum random access codes. Basically, they say, if Alice wants to send a quantum state to Bob, that will let Bob sort of learn any one of sort of n bits of his choice, right? Then, you know, even if Bob just has to learn sort of one of those bits of his choice, there's still nothing better that Alice can do than to send him n qubits, okay? There's no sort of compression that, Alice can get where, you know, she could just sort of pack all n of the bits into some log n qubit state or something like that, right? And so it's sort of a generalization of Holova's theorem that they proved. And so what I did is sort of took those, you know, that lemon and made lemonade of it, right? Or just, you know, took that sort of negative result. And this is not the first time, you know, that it's happened in sort of in computational learning theory. You can take a negative result that sort of limits what you can do, and you can say, all right, this is actually sort of limiting the sort of if you like, the sort of dimension or the complexity of quantum states sort of considered as a class of hypotheses, right? And you can then use that to sort of get an upper bound on how many measurements do you need in order to learn a quantum state, right? Because it's saying that a quantum state really does not have sort of an exponential number of independently accessible degrees of freedom, right? And again, this is very related to Holova's theorem, okay? So, and then, to finish it, you just have to sort of combine that with results in classical computational learning theory, which are due to Alana et al., due to Bartlett and Long, which basically say that if you've got sort of any class of real-valued functions that has sort of some limited dimension, or you know, if you've ever heard of VC dimension, sort of a certain generalization of that, that if this is bounded, that you can do this learning with just a small number of samples. So it's, you know, it's just sort of putting things together from these, you know, different fields and just sort of noticing you can do that. Okay. So what is this really, you know, so rather than talking about the proof, I wanted to just talk a little about what does this really mean. So, you know, you could sort of notice yesterday there's this sort of undercurrent, you know, hostility, but, there's this Bayesian creed, this maximum likelihood creed. You know, I'm not going to enter into the battle. I just, you know, wanted to suggest that you know, there can be a third alternative. Right? So, I mean, how does this learning approach compare to, you know, either the Bayesian or maximum likelihood approaches to quantum state learning? Well, to me, the main difference is that this learning approach does not require sort of assuming any kind of prior over quantum states, you know, even implicitly, okay? Which, you know, I think removes a lot of problems. You know, you don't have to worry about what is a uniform distribution over mixed states, what does that mean, you know, or is it only over pure states, you know, or is it uniform on the Bloch sphere, you know, this and that. You don't have to worry about it. Okay, so, you know, in computer science, the sort of standard thing to do is make sort of a worst case assumption about the universe, right? You know, we're sort of congenitally paranoid and pessimists, okay? And we assume, you know, not that there's some distribution, you know, over possible states of the universe, but that the universe is an enemy who is out to get us, okay? And, you know, we want to succeed regardless, okay? That's you know, what theoretical computer science is about, okay? And so what we do instead is we assume a sort of a distribution over measurements that you know, that we're going to apply, right? So we're trading sort of a distribution over states for this distribution D over possible measurements. You know, you might say that's a little strange. You know, where does this distribution come from? Or, you know, we know, well, you know, there could be, you know, different circumstances in which, you know, you have such a distribution. Like, for example, if your quantum state were sort of to represent, you know, some piece of software that, you know, you just wanted to make sure it succeeded on a random input, right? Or if, you know, maybe, you know, in experimental physics, you could think of circumstances where you don't really get to control which measurement you apply, but, you know, there's some, you know, there's something that happens, you know, well, Or, you know, or you can imagine that, that you can control which measurement to apply, but you know, you believe that, you know, there's some there's some assumption as to which measurements you're actually going to care about in the future. Okay, and you know, it seems to me like it might be preferable for some applications because, well, I mean, you really don't know what your state is, right? That's the whole problem of quantum state tomography, right? You know, why should you assume that you have a uniform distribution over states that you're starting with, right? Of course, you know, you know almost certainly it's not going to be uniform, right? You know that your state was produced by some process and that, you know, puts all sorts of limitations on it. So rather than making any sort of assumption about distribution over states, you can come up with an approach that will just get most of the measurements right, but that will work just as well given any state. Okay, so now the other question that I get asked by physicists, whenever I talk about this, you know, I'm sure it would come up eventually if I hadn't preempted it, is, what about, you know, can you generalize this to process tomography? Okay, and yeah.
I think this, sorry to interrupt this, but regarding the previous slide.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
What if I suggested instead that instead of being a third way, it is your approach is essentially a frequentist approach. I mean, you're right. There's no prior over states. I agree that it's not a Bayesian approach. Mm-hmm. But I'm not convinced that it's fundamentally different, at least in the dimension that we're talking about here, from a frequentist approach, in that it looks at the data and attempts to reproduce the data and to do nothing but reproduce to fit the data. And that to me is the core of the frequentist approach to statistics. There is something new because, as you point out, you're doing other things that are different. That's a sort of a perpendicular dimension to the Bayesian versus frequentist.
I see. No, that could very well be true. I mean, okay. So you know, regarding, you know, so I'm not a you know, this you know, I've read, you know, Chris Fuchs, I've read, you know, I'm still not completely clear on what a frequentist is. And but regarding maximum likelihood, you're right, to me, you know, all right, so that, you know, that is still making some sort of implicit assumption about a prior over states, right? Because you're basically taking a Bayesian approach, then you're just deciding to sort of discard all but the high point in your distribution, right? So, to me, there's still an implicit sort of assumption about the space that your states were drawn from there, and that's what I was trying to get away from. But no, it's an interesting debate. So, I don't, you know, I'm not going to commit to a strong opinion. So. Okay, so can you generalize this to process tomography? And I think this is actually a very instructive question to ask. The answer to it turns out to be no. Okay, so there's no such generalization, and this is actually quite easy to prove. Let's just suppose that, you know, the process you wanted to learn was some unitary. And let's just suppose that all it did is that, you know, each basis state, each computational basis state x, right, it either did nothing or it applied a minus one phase to it. Okay, and so it just mapped x to, you know, minus one to the f of x, where f is some arbitrary Boolean function. Okay, well, then the point is that the values, you know, these phases or these diagonal entries of this matrix you're trying to learn constitute 2 to the n independently accessible degrees of freedom. Okay, so it's not just that you have exponentially many degrees of freedom, but in this case, you can sort of learn about whichever one you might happen to be interested in just by feeding your process, you know, the appropriate input x. Okay, and so therefore, if we think of trying to, you know, pack learn a quantum process, right? Well, you know, you can feed it inputs, right? But just by Holovo's theorem, sort of each input you feed it, right, can at most sort of tell you n bits out of these 2 to the n bits that you're trying to learn. Okay, so, you know, you're going to need exponentially many queries, you know, even just to approximately learn this state, right? Even to sort of learn most of the values of f. Okay, and
maybe most unitaries, there would be a lot of
Oh, well, so no, you can prove that for most unitaries there isn't, because you prove that. Well, you can diagonalize it, and you can make some, find some basis in which it's diagonal, and then make the same kind of argument. Yeah. So.
Some of the processes and states to the state tomography in a larger Hilbert space.
So no, you can't. That's it's an interesting thing to try, and it's very instructive to sort of try that isomorphism and see what breaks down, right? And what breaks down when you try it is basically that you're going to be getting sort of if you map a process onto a state, well then okay, in some sense that state encodes everything the process could possibly do, but if you actually measure the state, then what you get out is you just learn about a random input to the process, not about specific input that you happen to care about. Okay. Yeah. So that's kind of the key difference between states and processes that makes this kind of learning possible in the one case and not in the other. Okay. So then the other question, I wonder about how do we actually go about I'm sorry, there was one other thing I wanted to mention, which is the other thing people ask is, all right, is it really essential that we are considering two outcome measurements, or what about K outcome measurements? Okay, well, we can handle sort of more outcomes. We just have to increase the number of sample measurements that we make by some factor which is polynomial in K, the number of outcomes. Okay. If you wanted to sort of learn to simulate sort of measurements on all n qubits, or measurements that had 2 to the n possible outcomes, then again, there's no hope for a learning theorem like this one, because even just to learn to simulate a single measurement, right, is going to require sort of an exponential amount of information before you can do that. Okay, but you can hope just the amount of sample data you'll need will just grow polynomially in K, the number of outcomes, and indeed that can be done. Okay. So then the other question was, how do we actually find the hypothesis state sigma? So as I mentioned, it can be found in time which is polynomial in the Hilbert space dimension. The basic problem is you're given these measurements, E1 up to EM. You're given their outcomes, and you want to find a hypothesis state that minimizes the sum of squares. Okay, well, some of you have probably seen this. This is just a convex programming problem. Okay, so therefore, sort of using known algorithms that can be solved, which in time, at least polynomial in the Hilbert space dimension. So at least exponential as opposed to doubly exponential. Okay, so. And in the general case, you cannot hope for better than that for very basic computational complexity reasons. Okay, so even if you were hoping, to just find a classical state or sort of a classical n-bit string that explains, all your measurement data, this is known to be at least as hard as sort of breaking all sorts of one-way functions in cryptography. Okay, so it's not quite known to be equivalent to the P versus NP question, right? But it's somehow very close to that. Okay, it's kind of a cryptographically difficult problem to sort of find a hypothesis that agrees with data. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it does require that the measurements have a structure that they can sort of encode a computation. Right, or that they can encode sort of the decoding function of your crypto system. Right. So
possible that for a wide range of, let's say, tensor product measurement, nice measurements,
yep,
we might actually expect better than this.
It is absolutely possible. And there's a whole research area in computer science in the classical case dealing with sort of in what cases can you do the learning efficiently, right? Or sort of what's the boundary, between what you can learn, with efficient computation and what you can't. And I think that is a fantastic research area, to get into in the quantum case. Now on Friday, Daniel is going to talk about reconstruction of stabilizer states. Okay, so in that case, you actually can do the learning efficiently computationally. Okay, it would be great to have other cases where you can do that. But at least we have one example. Okay. So So you know, so we, as I said, we know that you can solve convex programming in polynomial time. Turns out, Elad Hazan, who's an expert on optimization theory, I gave him this problem, and he came up with sort of a custom-designed convex optimization algorithm, which works really well for this particular problem. And well, it's shown here. To tell the truth, I don't really understand why it works, but he wrote a whole paper about it. And it's basically, you know, it's an iterative algorithm. It's, you know, you just take the matrix of partial derivatives of, you know, of your function. You just sort of keep moving along a gradient and sort of projecting into the cone of, you know, positive, you know, definite matrices with trace one. And so what he proved is that this algorithm actually works really well. It returns sort of a solution which is within epsilon of optimal after only log m divided by epsilon squared iterations. Okay, so, you know, there's not even any dependence on n there. So, okay. So what I did with my student Eyal Dechter. He implemented this convex programming algorithm in MATLAB. You know, if anyone wants the code, you know, we can give it, and you know, we still have to sort of write this up. We used actually a computing cluster, and so we. You know, I'm a theorist. You know, the best way I could describe this is we checked experimentally that the theorem that I proved is true. but you know, for I'm told that for experimentalists, this is a good thing to do. So yeah.
Go back to the last slide.
Yeah, sure.
Go to the theorem. Mm-hmm. The theorem guarantees the convergence of the code.
Oh, you want the theorem?
No. No. Just a slide.
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. You guarantee a convergence of that algorithm in logarithm of m in principle. So, where does the dimension of sigma enter here? Because don't you need to at least write down your result?
Oh, yeah, you do. So this is the number of iterations. Each iteration, obviously, takes time.
Oh, so each iteration in principle grows with sigma.
Well, yeah, that each iteration takes time. You know, well, you've got to compute an eigenvector. So that's basically an n cubed. Okay, so now what are the experiments that we ran? Well, we sort of, you know, we were trying, you know, hopefully some of you, you know, might be able to suggest to us better experiments to try, but here's what we came up with. The first was just a sanity check. We considered, you know, classical states, just, you know, sort of classical strings of n bits together with measurements that just sort of measure the ith bit and check if it's a 0 or a 1, okay? The algorithm had better work in this case. I'm just trying to learn a classical string. Okay, and then the you know more interesting thing was linear cluster states. So I just you know imagine we just sort of have a one-dimensional array of qubits. Okay, and so imagine that the true state that we're trying to learn, kind of the true hypothesis is the state that you would produce by first sort of you know making each of your qubits in the plus state, you know, in the 0 plus 1 over root 2, and then just to every adjacent pair of qubits applying this conditional phase that sort of you know inverts the phase if both the qubits are 1. Okay, and then you know we just looked at sort of measurements of sort of three adjacent qubits that just sort of somehow tried to measure something quantum, right, which would be you know, in this case, you would just sort of project onto a basis like that one. Okay, so then you know all of the acceptance probabilities are 3/4, and then we want to know sort of how many for how many of these sample measurements do you have to be told the outcome before your algorithm sort of figures out what the underlying state is. Okay, and then you know we wanted to really come up with an example that would really sort of showcase the you know the learning algorithm, right? And to have an interesting example, right? Of course, you can do learning if you know if all the measurements you know commute with each other, or if all the measurements you know each measurement only applies to a tiny number of qubits. But we wanted some example where all the measurements apply to all the qubits. And you know they don't commute with each other, but they still sort of yield interesting information, right? So you know it's actually it's not easy to come up with such examples, but There is one, you know, very interesting example from a paper by John Watrous in 2000. And this involves what's called this group membership problem. Okay, so the situation here is that we just identify the set of n bit strings with the group z2 to the n, right? And so just like the group of, you know, n bit strings under the operation of bitwise exclusive ORing. Okay. And now we'll consider like a subgroup H, that group of order 2 to the n minus 1. Okay, so now, you know, now our quantum state will be sort of an equal superposition over all 2 to the n minus 1 elements of that subgroup. Okay, and then there's a measurement corresponding to each element of the group G. And basically what that measurement does is it just checks whether that element is in the subgroup H or not. Okay, so it basically just compares that. That it sort of measures the inner product between that subgroup state H, right, and the coset sort of H times G, right, and it, you know, it checks whether their inner product is one as it would be if G is in H, or zero as it would be if G is not in H. Okay, and so the, you know, if you actually write down what the projector is, it's that thing there, and then such a measurement accepts with probability 1 if the element is in the subgroup, or with probability 1/2 if the element's not in the subgroup. Okay, you can check that. So then question is, you know, again, you're going to be told a bunch of outcomes of these measurements, right? And we know that sort of any subgroup, you know, in a finite group is determined by a logarithmic number of generators, right? But we want to actually see this in the quantum state learning algorithm, that after measuring a number of these measurement operators, which is only logarithmic in the order of the group, that our convex optimization algorithm ought to produce a quantum state, you know, which corresponds to the correct subgroup. Okay. It ought to sort of learn the right subgroup state from all these sort of, you know, these weird non-orthogonal measurements that we're making. Okay. Okay, so here's the data we have so far. You know, we're kind of still, you know, gathering more, but you know, in these three cases, you know, question is how many sample measurements do we need? Oh, I think I forgot to put on like what are delta and gamma and epsilon. We just fixed some values of all the error parameters. Okay, we just fixed the error parameters to some, you know, reasonable values, like, you know, like 1/50th or something, and then we looked at how many sample measurements do you need in order to learn the state to within those error parameters. Okay, so you can see, you know, for the classical n-bit string, you know, it's this bottom line, you know, and for subgroup state, it's the blue line, and for these linear cluster states, it's the red line. Okay, all three of them, you know, indeed, you can see. You know, after some sort of initial behavior, you know, they then sort of enter or appear to enter an asymptotic regime where they then just grow linearly and, you know, and not exponentially. Okay. So, you know, as indeed, you know, the theorem says. Okay. So theorem's true. Okay. So but one thing you might have worried about is, you know, is what are the constants involved, right? I don't know how to pin down the constants. If you were to actually see, you know, what you can prove, sort of combining the known results, you know, I think the constants would be pretty terrible. It'd be in the thousands or 10,000s. Okay, and you know, and here you actually see, at least in these cases, it's, you know, it's actually very, very reasonable. Yeah. Oh, so no, I forgot to do that. I can ask. You know, I mean, and when we write up the final version, we'll have that, but. You know, we were using a computing cluster for at least part of it. You know, MATLAB turns out to be very hard to parallelize, actually. But actually, for a lot of it, we're just using a single computer. And, you know, to get up to, like, 10 qubits, you know, to do these experiments would take a few days, basically. Okay. So. Okay, and then here's, you can see, dependence on 1 over gamma in different cases. So. In this case, you know, we know that it's got to increase. It's at most some polynomial in 1 over gamma. In the case, well, let's say we're just measuring a single qubit, it seems to go linearly with 1 over gamma. In the case of a subgroup state, you actually, after some small number of measurements, you just start being able to just get the state perfectly, and it just completely flattens out. So. So gamma is basically is the error parameter that describes like the difference between trace E sigma and trace E rho. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is how does the number of sample measurements you need, you know, increase as a function of 1 over gamma. Okay, and you can see, you know, we just fixed epsilon and delta, sort of other parameters, and we also fixed n. Okay, all right, so open problems. So to some extent, you know, this learning theorem is a solution in search of a problem. But, you know, I was trying to convince you that I think it's a pretty nice solution, you know, in search of a problem. So, find some sort of real experimental situation where, you know, you have this sort of distribution over measurements and where, you know, it would really make sense to do this. Okay, you know, it just, yeah. You know, and I would love to hear, you know, anyone's ideas about that. Okay, so, you know, and then this was already mentioned, find special classes of states for which learning can be done, you know, using computation time, which is polynomial in the number of qubits rather than just the number of measurements. So, you know, improve the parameters of the learning theorem. You know, we did experiments to say that, you know, actually in practice, you know, everything seems completely reasonable. It would be great to know that in theory also. Okay, to actually have, you know, have really tight parameters and have, you know, upper bounds that match the lower bounds and so on, which, you know, we don't have that quite yet. Okay. And, you know, I think it would be cool to, you know, to prove that the theorem is even more true. You could apply it to some real physics experiment rather than just numerical simulation data. That would be cool. So happy to take questions. Thanks. Thanks.
Your point of view, and I want to mention to those to the disbelievers that that actually it is pretty easy to understand that you can get the same precision with a linear number of measurements just by thinking that the big drawback of the maximum likelihood is that you have an exponential size of the matrix to store first, and then you have an exponential propagation of error if you want to take an ensemble average. Mm-hmm. But if you just get the ensemble average as an expansion over an information incomplete, whatever PRPM or quorum of observables, then you just need a linear number some way of measurements, which is just the idea of the Monte Carlo method, no? Mm-hmm. When you have a many dimension, you have an exponential time in, mm-hmm. in performing an integral or a measurement, or in this, the integral would be an average, mm-hmm. right? Otherwise, you can just use a Monte Carlo way, and mm-hmm. the same.
Right.
So this is, I think, a very important, one of the most important issues, so that the complexity of, there is something that, actually I would love also to understand the relation between this convex method and the quantum comb estimation. Which is a convex method. It's okay. A convex method. It's okay. You have the same situation.
Mm-hmm.
But there is one thing that I really not sure I agree. The okay. interpretation mm-hmm. that you say is non-Bayesian. Because the typically, I don't know, if your method has to do with the classical statistical learning frame, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. essentially the Kolmogorov kernel, they call Mercier kernel, mm-hmm. approach, but you have an hypothesis space, mm-hmm. and then you have a regularization
okay.
term, Titchenoff regularization, mm-hmm. that both have an interpretation in a Bayesian sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you cannot avoid Bayesian, I think. Mm-hmm. Is an infinite debate about frequentistic and mm-hmm. Bayesian, which we'll never end. Yeah. Is a metaphysical.
Right.
In my opinion,
right. Well, it depends what the
yeah, I guess. Yeah. No, I actually.
What is this name space must be there in some sense, right. At least. Bayesianly, you believe quantum mechanics.
I do, but you know, I guess the point is, you know, you can interpret sort of any sufficiently, you know, broad framework in terms of, you know, in any other such framework, right? It's like, you know, the Church Turing equivalent or something. So yes, you can put this computational pack learning into Bayesian terms. I agree with you. You can do that. The question is just what's the most useful way of thinking. Right? But yeah, thanks.
forces for this learning algorithm is polynomial. Is that true?
The measurements you have to do. Are
the number of measurements.
The number of measurements.
So this is, you know, with respect to experimental demonstration, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, the way I understand is that most of your measurements require, you know, n-body correlated, you know, interactions.
Well, you can consider whatever measurements you want.
Yeah, but no. What do you mean? So can you do that for only, you know, single two-body measurements with polynomial resources, like polynomial number?
Oh, you're saying what measurements can you actually apply?
Yeah, exactly.
That's a good point. You could say that, all right, in practice, we only care anyway about measurements that can be applied by polynomial-sized quantum circuits. So why not just restrict attention to those? And,
yeah.
You know, you can do that. It's true. And, you know, and the theorem, you know, still applies. Right? You might, you know, you could still worry, all right, what, you know, still, if you want to predict the outcomes of sort of, you know, all possible, you know, or sort of, let's say you want to predict the outcomes of most measurements that, you know, could be applied by quadratic size circuits, right? Can you do that, you know, after, you know, making a polynomial number of such measurements, right? It's still not obvious, but my theorem says that yes, indeed, that's the case.
So you're saying that your theorem is valid even if you are, from the beginning, restrict your measurements to only single or at least two-body.
It's valid for any distribution over measurements. Does not, you don't have to have a uniform distribution. It can be any distribution you want. It can be concentrated. It can have all its weight on, you know, on single qubit measurements or on two-body measurements. Anything you like.
But that should lead to different error things. You know, a conversion. How does it? You know. It cannot have the same scale-up. I cannot believe
no,
that.
No,
it
no,
have
you,
the same number of measurements m, regardless of, you know, how many.
You do. It's, first of all, it's an upper bound. You could do, for some distributions, you might do better than the upper bound. But that upper bound holds for any distribution over measurements.
Okay.
Okay.
So my question is about something that's not, that maybe not quite within the parameters of what you've done. But say you have a situation where doing an entangled measurement is difficult.
Yeah.
Like most of the experiments.
Yes.
So then can you do something where with single qubit measurements,
mm-hmm.
albeit maybe mm-hmm. an extra square number of them,
mm-hmm.
that you can learn enough out of the single qubit measurements mm-hmm. to be able to learn something about the entangled measurements?
Okay, so even just information theoretically, right, that's not going to be possible in general, right? I claim that's not the fault of my theorem, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there is information, right, you know, in the sort of entanglement between multiple qubits, but you could never get out by just single qubit measurements, right?
Well,
so, and that year you can't.
Single qubit measurements are topographically complete.
Right.
But are you talking about sort of the measurements on all n of the qubits at once?
Tensor product.
Tensor product, right.
That
then takes you into a different regime.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm talking about sort of two outcome measurements here.
Okay, but you said it could also be extended.
It can be extended to more outcomes. What?
No, but it could be a two.
You can make tensor product measurements. You can just measure tensor products of Pauli's,
mm-hmm.
right? Those are two outcome.
Okay.
So they're tensor products.
They're
completely experimentally realizable.
Right.
They're two
outcome,
and they're topographically complete.
So in that case, you know, you can, if that is your distribution over measurements, then you can, you know, you'll then be able to predict most further measurements from that same Pauli distribution.
But as I understand it,
yeah.
if you make tensor products of single qubit measurements, then it allows you to predict future results for tensor products of single qubit measurements.
Yes, that's right.
What I'm asking is, can you do something with where you need more single qubit
mm-hmm.
measurements, but from those tensor products
mm-hmm.
of single qubit measurements,
mm-hmm.
you can actually predict the result of, say, Bell correlation measurements.
Topographically complete.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
But the question is how many.
What I'm saying is, can you do better than?
Yeah, you don't have to ask the quantitative question. So there could be, you know, cases in which that's possible. I'd be happy to talk about it offline if you want. My theorem on its own doesn't say anything about that, right? It requires that, you know, you be tested on the same material that was in class, right? And yeah, in general, you're going to have to make some such assumption. But in computational learning theory, people have considered situations where the distribution you're tested on is different from the one you're trained on. Sometimes you can do something in that case, but, you know, it's always going to be a game of, you know, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose.
It's just a question of error propagation, because
you do this class of measurements, so you can then predict with errors that you've bounded all of the other separable measurements. And you know basically how to propagate the errors from those to your estimate of the density matrix and then to the other measurements you want to do, which will all be linear.
The problem is that you don't actually predict on all the measurements, just most of the measurements in the original.
So,
So that makes it
more tricky. So in a way, for most of this, so the set that you can efficiently estimate are measure zero, because they're like most of the states for n qubit systems are highly entangled, and either you have to do this kind of this distribution over correlated measurements, which they have exponential depth in quantum resources, or you cannot estimate those with only tensor product of the qubit measurements.
You can learn them. Those information are not possible to obtain. It's not the definition of learning. It's sufficient to write down the maximally mixed state.
That's an important point. I should clarify this. I didn't remember saying this before. But if you pick like a random state under the Haar measure, completely random state, whatever your distribution, as a hypothesis for that state, the maximally mixed state is going to be a very good hypothesis, right? Because, for most measurements, the random state looks just like the maximally mixed state, right? And so that's if your goal is learning, then that's a perfectly good hypothesis, right? But, the case where my theorem becomes non-trivial is where the measurements that you're interested in sort of mesh up with the state that you're measuring in a non-trivial way.
So you're in principle generating you call that sigma, so a density matrix for a state. Did you compare this density matrix to the density matrix you start with? So I mean, because this density matrix you're generating is designed to best fit the experiment or the measurements. And I wonder if that maybe by coincidence actually might come close to the real state you're kind of simulating to do the measurement on.
So in these specific cases, I think it did do that. I would have to check. There could be some degrees of freedom if there are different states that do equally well, in which case, you can't really predict what the convex optimization is going to return. But I think, we basically had come up with examples such that, if you want to find a state that, explains these measurement results, you're basically forced to find the state that we want. Right, and indeed it finds that state, right? So, you could come up with other examples where it has more freedom in what to do.
It would just be interesting to see, for instance, the distance measure, how that scales the real state and the state you're generating as your sigma. Just to see that. Of course, you might get a state out of it, as you said, right? If you pick a random state, your algorithm might just generate the maximally mixed state as an estimate to predict the measurements. But even though that won't be the true state you actually kind of picked, right, as a quantum state. Because, I mean, if that would be the case, so your estimate in principle fitting your matrix, density matrix you're fitting on your data would get close to the real density matrix, then you could really use your estimate to predict other types of measurements.
In that case, you could.
So when I first heard about your theorem, I thought this can't be right. This has to be wrong. And then I realized that it was right. And the thing that made it make sense to me was that if your measurement set is a uniform distribution over a tomographically complete set, then you can your algorithm or any algorithm that satisfies the theorem can essentially look at that and say, oh, the maximally mixed state will be a good estimate. And so I thought at the time that, all right, this is great, because when it's going to be exponentially hard to do the tomography, then the learning algorithm will, give a kind of a trivial answer. Then I learned about this result that Daniel's going to talk about on Friday, which I guess maybe I'll let the cat out of the bag, but is that if you have so if you have a totally an unknown stabilizer state, and the measurements that you seek to predict are all the Paulis, then in fact it is possible to identify that state perfectly. Whereas because that measurement set is so big in your learning algorithm, your learning algorithm would happily just write down the maximally mixed state, which is sort of admission of failure.
Right.
I'm curious about, do you have any thoughts on when that gap, in other words, when there is actually something possible that's much better than what your learning algorithm would do?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question. What Daniel's going to talk about is, you know, is strictly sort of incomparable with my result, right? Because it's for a special class of states, but it does something that, you know, my learning theorem would not do in that case, right? Which is, so, you know, it works for sort of even measurements that have n bit outputs, right? So, so in that case, sort of it's possible somehow because of the structure of stabilizer states, I guess, because actually there's not a doubly exponential number of stabilizer states. There's just a singly exponential number of them. And furthermore, sort of stabilizer states can sort of be searched through sort of using, you know, various types of linear algebra, right? It's not like solving an NP-complete problem, right? So, there could be other interesting classes of states where that sort of thing is possible. I don't know. It's a great question.
Time for one last polynomial time question. Seeing none, let's just thank the speaker again. Half an hour for coffee and continued discussion. So we'll come back here at 11:15.